This podcast of the Radio Cafe comes to you via radiocafe.org, where you can find more information and many other podcasts. Technical support comes from Studio X, providing website design, hosting, e-commerce, and social media marketing, serving Santa Fe to the world since 1994. Find out more at studiox.com. I'm delighted to welcome back to the Radio Cafe Mirabai Starr. She's a translator of the Spanish mystics John of the Cross and Teresa of Avila. She's award-winning author of the book The God of Love, A Guide to the Heart of Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. She's a teacher and leader in the emerging interspiritual movement, which we'll talk about what that is in a moment. And she's author of the new memoir, Caravan of No Despair. She will be speaking on Sunday, the 6th of December at 5 o'clock at Bookworks in Albuquerque. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte. It's wonderful to be with you.
It's great to have you. And it was such an interesting book to read because you were the daughter of what you might call counterculture hippies who, I mean, you started out in New York and then ended up living on a beach in the Caribbean and then ended up in Taos, and I mean, somebody gave you LSD without your knowing it when you were really still a child, and it was a kind of interesting path and characterized by an awful lot of death at an early age. The first person in your life to die was your older brother, and it just kept going from there.
Yeah, it was sort of a cascade of death and dying in my life that is really kind of marked my development as a human being. But in spite of how that might sound, I am not a sad, morose, tragic person. My life is filled with a lot of wonder.
You had kind of early tendencies toward spirituality and mysticism, and I couldn't help thinking, I mean, I found reading your memoir very emotional, and I would get mad at people, and I would love other people, and I would identify with you as you were going through your life, but I found myself getting really mad at that grown-up who basically was feeding punch glasses full of LSD to children, and I wondered, like, in retrospect, I mean, what was it like then, and how do you think about that now as an event in your life?
You know, looking back on the early 70s and the whole counterculture movement, which my parents were very much part of in Taos, you know, in Taos in the early 70s, it wasn't just the hippie scene. It was the back to the land movement. So these were people who were trying to create conscious community and very much engaged in what's now called sustainability. But there was a definite shadow side, you know, the sex, drugs, and rock and roll, well, at least sex and drugs, aspect of that countercultural movement wasn't always as conscious as I think the adults wished that they were being. And in many ways, the whole social structure was up for grabs at that time. You know, when my parents left their middle-class lifestyle in New York and ended up in Taos, they were leaving behind everything, not just a geographical area, not just a socioeconomic reality, which they were. They gave it all away and took on radical voluntary simplicity. But they were, all the social norms were up for grabs, and so there was a lot of experimentation going on, and the children in many ways were the victims of this. And the adults, you know, my parents and their friends now have a lot of remorse about some of the neglect of children and the things that would now clearly be labeled as abusive, like allowing kids to have access to LSD, other drugs.
Right, and other drugs. And that particular moment created a kind of experience of leaving your body and blurring the boundaries between reality and your imagination. And I couldn't help but think that, I mean, either that experience led you to be who you are, or it just opened up that mystical side that was latent in you anyway.
Right. So in some ways you could see it as abusive and harmful, because you're right, I entered into these kind of dissociative states that were very painful and scary and uncomfortable for years, actually, as you read in the book. But it also did, it was a portal, as LSD is for many people, preferably people much older than I was, or psychedelics were, to other states of consciousness that then led me onto my spiritual path, as did death. You know, all those different deaths in my life from a young age were doorways to a spiritual journey. And I wouldn't trade those experiences in the sense that they really did give me my soul. But on the other hand, harm was done, no doubt. And yet, I think, Mary Charlotte, that this is the premise of the whole book, that we're vast enough beings, all of us, to contain that whole range from the positive to the negative, from the broken to the radiant, in the same vessel of one, you know, one human soul.
Yeah. Well, and it did make me think about that whole question of what, I mean, everybody's big questions, everyone who's got kids has big questions about parenting, and you became a parent later, and we'll talk about that, but what's the right way to raise a kid? Because, I mean, you suffered and went through a great deal, one could say, too early, but also it made you this person that you are, and a very interesting and a very strong person.
Mm.
And so, you know, I read so much about people who are so trying to protect their children from any harm at all, and it sort of reminds me of the story of the Buddha who grew up in this sort of perfection, and it wasn't until he was older first saw somebody who was crippled, and suddenly everything opened up. The world is not a perfect place. Well, of course it isn't.
That's right. In fact, that reminds me of another story of the Buddha. You know, the one about the mustard seed, where a young mother comes to him with the body of her child in her arms who's died. And she begs the Buddha, who she's heard is a miracle worker, to bring him back to life. And the Buddha says, sure, I'll be happy to do that for you. But first you have to do something for me, and that is to go from door to door throughout the village and knock on every door. And if you find one household that has not been touched by death and ask for a mustard seed and bring it back to me, then I will bring your child back to life. And of course, there is no household in the universe, let alone in any village, that has not been touched by death. That is the human condition.
How did you get the name Mirabai? That wasn't the name that your parents gave you.
Right. My given name was Paula Starr. And actually, even Starr is kind of a made-up name in the sense that it's an Ellis Island name. When my grandfather immigrated from Russia, and they didn't bother to try to pronounce his real name. But Mirabai was a 16th century East Indian poet, an ecstatic poet saint who was in love with Lord Krishna, the god of love. And when I was 13, I was in a play. I went to an alternative school in Taos. In those days, we called them free schools. And it was run by the Lama Foundation, where Ram Dass wrote Be Here Now in 1970. And so when I was 13, which would have been 1974, the children produced a play about the life of this great poet, Mirabai, this devotional poet, and based on a comic book that our teachers brought back from India. And I was cast as Mirabai, and I was given the name after that.
Now, one of the things that you describe in your memoir is feeling kind of alienated from your family, although, I mean, obviously they loved you very much and did take care of you, but that sense that you were really different from them. And then one day, a middle-aged man who was like the age of your parents and had kids your age recognized you and said, I know who you are, and basically set himself up to be your spiritual teacher. And that was another moment in that book where, I mean, you don't know whether to appreciate this guy for seeing you or hate him for all the bull poo that he perpetrated.
Right, because he definitely manipulated that one. I mean, maybe he saw something real. I don't know what he saw. But he convinced me that I was this very special being, and it was his job to kind of awaken me to my true goddess nature. and I was so broken at that time. My older brother had died a few years before. My first love, my first boyfriend, had just died. He'd been killed in an accident. My father was an alcoholic, and my mother had just gotten together with another man who was also an alcoholic, and I was so vulnerable to being told that I was this extraordinary creature that was about to flower into my true self. And this guy said, just, you know, follow me and I will be the one to bring your spiritual life into fruition. And of course he took total advantage of me. And in those days that kind of abuse was less visible because of the whole countercultural, you know, there were no rules. It was the Wild West in many ways culturally. And yet he knew it was wrong because he insisted that it be kept secret the entire time. It went on for years.
Yeah, and now he'd be in jail for a felony.
Yes, absolutely.
And you married him.
And then I did marry him later and adopted children with him.
And then how did you kind of come to your senses and decide to leave?
Love. I fell in love with someone else. Yeah, and he was the catalyst for getting me out of that really dark prison that I was in with this much older man for many years, who was also an alcoholic, surprise, surprise. And the person who was my catalyst actually turned out to not be there on the other side.
Right. As often happens, the person who gets you out is not the one that you end up with. And you did end up with a wonderful man who's sitting here somewhere in the baking company.
That's right.
But it's so interesting because, I mean, here in New Mexico, there are a lot of people who are pursuing a spiritual path of one kind or another. And I think there's a lot of depth to a lot of what people are doing with that here. There's a lot of really people who are deeply practicing meditation or other practices and putting them into practice in their lives and doing good work of one kind or another on the basis of that. But when you see people like this, I mean, he clearly talked a good game. This guy whom you call Randy Sanders, that's his name in the book, not his real name. But when you left him, he basically showed his true colors as a vindictive animal.
Yeah, and mentally ill.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Which I think I kind of kept his pieces and parts together for many years. I knew he was unstable, and I was kind of his ground in many ways. And that when that fell out from under him, yes, it was not a pretty picture.
And then your spiritual life kind of fell apart, which must have been really confusing because that was a big part of your identity. But anything that was even associated with that was associated with this pretty awful man.
Right. So I had to fire God. You know, I was always kind of skeptical anyway. I grew up in a family of secular Jews who were, I wouldn't exactly call them atheists, but they pretty close. I mean, they had a deep sense of the soul in the kind of Jungian meaning of that word. And, you know, my father was into reading tarot cards, and my mother was interested in kind of native and indigenous traditions, but mostly they were really anti-religion. So I grew up with a good deal of critical thinking with regard to religions that never left me. I never bought in hook, line, and sinker to any religious or spiritual tradition, even though I was attracted to and deeply engaged with many. But I never became a fundamentalist anything because I think my family conditioning was such that I couldn't, you know, I always had that questioning mind. And so when I left Randy Sanders and struck out on my own, I had to go through a period of leaving all spiritual forms behind. But that didn't last too long because I have this deeply devotional heart and it brought me back.
Yeah, I mean, I was trying to imagine you as a young person singing with all your heart to Lord Krishna. This little Jewish girl in Taos.
That's right.
It seemed like it came from the deepest place.
Yeah, I think it did. And I think that those early deaths had kind of broken me open at a young age and triggered a kind of longing in me. And I think this book deals a lot with the connection between grief and spiritual longing, which for me have always been deeply intertwined. And I think for a lot of people, there's this connection. Because when loss breaks open your heart, it opens us to the kind of the deeper strains of the human condition, and that connects us with a yearning for something larger that is mysterious.
We're talking to Mirabai Starr about her memoir, Caravan of No Despair. How did you come to translate St. John of the Cross, to translate his work, Dark Night of the Soul, into English? It's an interesting story that you tell about how everybody wanted to read the book, but the translation into English was just so terrible that nobody could get through it.
Yeah, there were a couple of existing English translations done by Catholic priests in the 1930s and then again in the 1950s. And they were very rigid, very literal, very dogmatic. And I loved this text, Dark Night of the Soul. I felt that it spoke a universal language of spiritual maturing or spiritual unfolding, because the dark night of the soul is all about when we're navigating a spiritual path for quite some time, there always comes a period into the life of any mature spiritual practitioner where the things that used to turn us on and make us feel this sense of connectedness to the spiritual begins to dry up and become kind of meaningless, a sort of existential crisis, but much, much deeper than that. And that really spoke to me, and I knew that it would speak to a lot of other people. So I decided to write a book proposal and see if I could translate Dark Night of the Soul into an accessible contemporary English that transcends religiosity and reaches people of any and maybe no spiritual tradition. This was a time when there were a lot of new translations of spiritual classics because of Robert Bly and Coleman Barks doing Rumi primarily. It really opened the door for me to try my hand at this spiritual classic. And I was a writer. I was a poet myself, and Spanish is my other language. I'm fluent in Spanish. And there were a lot of things. I loved the text. I love the beauty of language, of any language. I love writing, good writing. And I spoke Spanish, so I decided to try it, and it sold right away. And that opened the way for all my other books, 13 other books on the mystics. This is the first book, though, really, that's personal.
This memoir.
Yeah, this memoir, Caravan of No Despair.
Yeah. Let's talk for a moment about St. John of the Cross, Dark Night of the Soul. What does the term Dark Night of the Soul mean to you? You write about it a little bit in the book. A lot of people are thinking they have a dark night of the soul. And at some point you thought, nah, they're amateurs. They don't even know what they're talking about when they say that. But like after everything that you've been through, what does that term mean to you now?
Well, as I mentioned a moment ago, a dark night of the soul, according to St. John of the Cross, who coined that term, is really a spiritual crisis. It's deeply personal, private, often invisible to anyone on the outside, like it doesn't necessarily have anything to do with external circumstances like a difficult divorce or, losing a business or some other series of events that take us to our knees. It's about a period on our spiritual path where we no longer are motivated by the kind of goodies, what St. John of the Cross calls consolations, that used to keep us going, like the high that you get when you're chanting, say, kirtan in the Hindu tradition, which many of us around here are into, or those other kinds of spiritual practices that make us feel that sense of connectedness to the holy. Moreover, in a deeper, darker, dark night of the soul, all the conceptual frameworks kind of come apart and no longer prop us up. Any ideas of the spiritual life, karma, or any of the other notions or doctrines become kind of meaningless. And our souls are wanting something much deeper that we can't seem to find, which John of the Cross says is union with the beloved. I love the Spanish mystics for their use of love language. It's so lush.
How do you say that in Spanish?
El amado.
El amado.
St. John of the Cross first wrote a poem, Dark Night of the Soul, and then was asked to write a prose commentary to explain the poem. But like the Song of Songs in the Bible, that original poem never mentions God or Jesus. It's all this sort of erotic love poem about the secret rendezvous between lover and beloved in the garden in the middle of the night. And el amado, la amada en el amado transformada. This transformation of lover and beloved. It's all about the soul having union with the great mystery, with the divine, like a drop of water merging into the boundless sea. And John says that's what's really going on in A Dark Night, is that we're being freed of the obstacles that prevent us from having having direct communion with the divine.
When that book was published, a copy of it arrived from the publisher, and a half an hour later, a state police trooper also arrived at your door to tell you that your daughter had been killed in a car accident. And it's almost too literary to be true, the juxtaposition of this and the content of the book. I mean, Dark Night of the Soul, followed by every parent's worst fear realized. Did the book help you at all? I mean, did this knowledge that St. John of the Cross worked hard to give everybody centuries later, did it have any effect?
Nope. I mean, I wish I could say that it did. It has since. But at the time and for a long time afterwards, it was like a cruel irony that the publication of this book, my new translation of Dark Night of the Soul, coincided exactly with the death, sudden, completely unexpected death of my daughter, of the child of my heart, you know, the person I was closest to in this world and for whom I was responsible. So no, it just seemed cruel and impossible to put those two things together. And yet, little by little, they integrated. And I recognized that I was walking the path that John of the Cross was speaking about, which was a path of fire, a path of unbearable anguish, and one in which, because of the nature of fire, everything that I could have hoped to rely upon to save me was obliterated by Jenny's death, by the trauma, by the loss. And so I rested in fire, in radical unknowingness, and little by little began to recognize that that's what John of the Cross was speaking about, that there is nowhere to go in a dark night of the soul. There is nothing to save us. There's nothing we can do on our own to remedy our brokenness. And so we can only surrender to the darkness, which turns out to be, according to John of the Cross, unutterable radiance. That's why it's blinding. It's actually not darkness, it's light. And we don't have the eyes to see. Now, I'm not suggesting that the death of a child has any redeeming value. It has none, still, as far as I can tell. And yet here I am, and my life is filled with joy and with goodness, and I am connected to many people, and like so many other grieving parents or grieving people of any flavor, my life is dedicated to trying to help other people survive their losses. And that's really what I hope this book will do, with the help and the guidance of these Spanish mystics that I happen to be intimate with, John of the Cross and Teresa of Avila, who carry some kind of secret medicine, as Rumi says, the poet Rumi says, there is a secret medicine given only to those who hurt so hard they cannot hope. The hopers would feel slighted if they knew. And the mystics carry some secret medicine. And for some reason, I get to share that with people.
We're talking to Mirabai Starr about her book, Caravan of No Despair. We get to know your daughter, Jenny, whom you adopted when she was a small child, who's beautiful and interesting and was really starting to walk her own spiritual path. And again, it brings up really big questions about that borderline between spiritual experience and mental illness. And when you look at this girl who became completely out of control and by Western definitions psychotic, she was also seemed to be channeling some kind of radiant love from another place.
You know, it's a topic. Again, this is sort of ironic in a cruel way. It was a topic I've always been interested in. In fact, when Jenny died, I was in the middle of writing a novel. And and the novel was semi-autobiographical. Because both of my daughters are adopted, I've always had this kind of fantasy about their birth mothers. So I was writing this novel called My Daughter's Mothers. And I was imagining Jenny's birth mother, who I knew to be bipolar. That's how she lost Jenny at a very young age. I was imagining her to be this brilliant, bipolar, you know, genius. And so I was doing a lot of research on the connection between genius and mental illness. But genius of any kind and psychosis of any kind have always been intimately entwined, whether it's artistic genius, scientific genius, or spiritual genius. There's hardly anyone that I've ever heard of or encountered who has great gifts that doesn't also have deep, dark shadows and suffer for their brilliance. So,
and sometimes, yeah, and sometimes people who are bipolar and have that kind of crazy giftedness, and I've known people like this, have had to make the choice between whether to take lithium and balance themselves out or whether to channel whatever this great gift is that they have, musical or otherwise.
Yeah, and that's not a bridge we ever ended up having to cross, but I have certainly wondered, because Jenny died in the onset of bipolar disorder, and I wasn't expecting it because she was only 14. In fact, I never really thought of it at all, even though I knew perfectly well that her birth mother had been severely mentally ill and had been hospitalized for most of her adult life. I never imagined that it would happen to Jenny so young. I hadn't begun to think about it. Jenny was a very stable kid, a high achiever, a brilliant student, a leader among her peers. There was no indication until that last week of her life.
You write in your memoir that probably any mother or parent who has lost a child at some moment has a craving for their own death. And you sort of describe what that is, what that allure is.
You know, the book's only been out a month, and it's getting a lot of attention, a lot of reviews, and I'm getting a lot of letters, both by email and on Facebook, from other mothers. And there are three things they're saying about the book. They can't stop reading, people, whoever, whether they've experienced the death of a child or not. They can't stop reading it. And the other thing is the mothers who identify with it are so relieved that I say things like that. Like, I name the things that are taboo. Things like, we want to die when our children die. And that I have become a certified bereavement counselor in the last 15 years and 13 years, something like that. And I work a lot with other bereaved parents, and every single mother I've ever sat with admits, you know, reluctantly sometimes, and sometimes openly, that she wants to go with her child. It's very difficult to be on this planet when your child has died, because we feel that we have, well, there are all kinds of reasons. One is we want to accompany our child to wherever it is that he or she has gone, because we feel this sense of protectiveness. So we want to go to the other side. And also there's the sense of having failed our mission as human beings, which is to protect our child at all costs. Not just mothers, fathers too, of course. And It's irrational in most cases, but it's, I think, very natural. And being able to tell these truths is really a relief.
Did this bring you closer to your mother, who had also lost her son?
Yes. Yeah, I know. You know, in most cultures, it's, other than contemporary Western culture, it's very common to have at least one child per generation in a family die. But in our culture, it's more unusual, and I couldn't believe that my mother lost her 10-year-old son to cancer, my brother Maddie, when I was 7. And then here it was happening to me again. My mother was with me when the police came, and she was holding me when I fell apart in those moments. And I knew right then that we had a connection that was beyond any expectation I ever had. I don't know if it brought me closer to her. I've always been very close to my mom, but yes, there is a certain something that we share now that we never would have wanted to, and that I share with all parents who have lost a child. We call it the club that nobody would ever belong to, and yet there is this comfort in knowing that there are many of us.
Do you ever feel the presence of your daughter?
You know, because Dark Night of the Soul came out the day Jenny died, because that was my first book. Okay, so get this. Jenny died when she was 14. On the 14th anniversary of her death, which was October 30th, 2015, last month, my book about her came out. So there are all of these ways of these intersections, and that was my 14th book.
Yeah.
And so all of my other books feel guided by Jenny in some ways. I mean, at the risk of sounding overly metaphysical, which I'm still cynical about. I'm a philosophy professor. I'm a trained cynic in many ways. But yes, there are so many synchronicities and intersections that I can only pay attention to them. And many things feel guided by Jenny. You know, every time, I'm also a speaker and teacher, and so every time I step onto stage or enter a room to offer some kind of teaching, I call on her. Say, okay, Jen, it's you and me. Let's do this thing. I feel like we're a team.
Mirabai Starr is author of the new memoir, Caravan of No Despair. She's written many other books, including translations by Spanish mystics like Teresa of Avila and St. John of the Cross. She will be speaking on Sunday, December 6th at 5 o'clock at Bookworks in Albuquerque. Is there a website where people can find out more about your work?
Sure. It's my name, Mirabai Starr, which is MirabaiStarr.com.
Mirabai, thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thanks for your wonderful questions, Mary Charlotte.
Thanks for listening to the podcast. To support the program, you can go to radiocafe.org. Many thanks to StudioX.com for their technical support and web design.